Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream. In a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. It's your programme about money, work and the economy. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, Bill Gates has told the BBC that there's a serious malnutrition crisis affecting children around the world and tells us that governments need to do more to help. Inside Thailand's plan to give out cash to low-income households.
It's pretty a bold move on her part to start off with the programme so soon in her leadership.
And 24-hour party people, how will Montreal's economy benefit from extending their drinking hours?
On the economic side, there's an opportunity to economic growth on that sector. But on the other hand, it's to also to reinforce the importance of the cultural scene in the nightlife.
That's all coming up here on World Business Report in the next 30 minutes. First then, the Microsoft founder, Bill Gates, is calling for an urgent increase in global health spending to tackle malnutrition in children. He's told the BBC that African countries need help to increase their production of nutritious food. A report from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation warns that 40 million additional children will suffer from hunger in the coming years because of climate change and a drop in aid in Africa from nearly 40% of the global trade in 2010 to just 25%.
The data actually was a bit uncertain in terms of what kids were dying of and where kids were malnourished. And so a huge investment by the foundation has been creating a data system. And that's where this understanding that over 50% of these deaths, if the kid was not malnourished, they would have been able to survive. And the group that takes all this data and pulls it together, they started out where they were just gathering the data and looking at what happened. But then as they've gotten more sophisticated, they do forecasts now. And so they're able to look at what's going on with climate and what's going on with fertility and economic growth. And they're able to say that unless we intervene with better seeds, better approaches, that climate change will be responsible for a significant increase in malnutrition.
So what can be done? Well, Bill Gates has told the BBC that aid from rich countries needs to return to the level it was at 5 years ago.
The period 2000 to the start of the pandemic, everybody should be very, very proud that aid generosity cut the childhood death rate in half. And the biggest reason for that was things like vaccines from Gavi for diarrhea and pneumonia and things like bed nets from Global Fund. So we were spoiled. I mean, that was great. Deaths were going down. Since the start of the pandemic, not just the pandemic, but the interest payments and the cuts in aid mean that we're flat. Whether it's improving malnutrition or reducing deaths, we're basically flat. And so this year, we're particularly focusing on nutrition. But our overall message is, hey, health in Africa, let's get back to the generosity and the progress that was miraculous to 2019.
A long-standing United Nations target is that developed countries should devote 0.7% of their gross national income to foreign aid. The latest figures from the OECD suggest that only a handful of countries are actually meeting that target. Let's talk now to Stefan Durkon. He is a professor of development economics at the University of Oxford in the UK. Stefan, first of all, can you take us through those figures? Who's donating what? Who are the big donors and who have dropped off?
Well, actually, most donors have somehow dropped off. You know, relative to this target of 0.7, on average, it's probably only about half of that that gets spent. But probably the most important thing is not necessarily the decline in aid itself, but actually where it's allocated to. A lot of aid at the moment, because of the nature of Ukraine as a, not as a high-income country, a lot of aid that goes to Ukraine can count as development aid, but that's taken away from a lot of the budgets. There's a lot of spending on within refugee costs in country, and it comes down to now that in most countries, actually the actual spending on places like Africa and development needs in these places has gone down dramatically. Virtually all countries are declining.
So it sounds like there's a decline, but also a kind of recirculation of where the money is going. If you take into account the fact that we've just been through this pandemic and governments are still counting the cost of that, is it surprising, do you think? Is it what we would expect?
Well, look, it doesn't surprise me as an observer of this whole thing that in the end, you know, that when somehow public support also for some of these causes goes down when there are challenges at home. So it doesn't surprise me, but it is very striking that big crises like Ukraine didn't get additional money really in terms of the aid budget, but actually took it away then from other places where Bill Gates correctly said, you know, needs are enormous, and taking away money from there is very striking and unfortunate.
How viable is it, do you think, for governments to up their spending again when economies, you know, start to bounce back? The new UK government has said that it will increase spending back to 0.7% when the economic climate improves. Do you think others will do the same?
I think it will take a bit of time. And I think for now, the way to think about it is really, you know, budgets are flat, lot of spending on Ukraine and related to in-country refugee costs. And then relative shift of priorities, climate change is on top of the agenda, of course, an existential crisis. But arguably, a lot of development agencies and countries spending on aid move their aid to that and take it away from much more immediate needs, such as the kind of issues that Bill Gates was just highlighting. And that's basically not additional money that's coming in for these new crises and so on. So I'm actually quite pessimistic at the moment. And in fact, these numbers are down and I don't see them increasing rather rapidly.
That 0.7 figure was agreed in the 60s, I understand. Some might argue that it's time to review that 0.7 figure up.
The figure of 0.7 was arguably not based on you know, hard evidence. It was in the 60s derived, and people had done some research and had found some number that was needed in terms of flows to these countries for them to allow them to converge to richer economies. We should more look at it as a norm. It's a norm that somehow got established and got firmly established in the 1970s, and people find it quite useful that everybody has a norm. You know, the problem with a norm like that that is expressed as a percentage means that if there is a chance for a Ministry of Finance in this budget crisis to actually say, can I spend it maybe opportunistically more on certain things that I can put into that budget, rather than actually saying, look, it's need-based or it's based on some other commitment. So what we're seeing here is not so much the problem with the 0.7 or the 0.5 or whatever, but actually this kind of more other needs that are put into that budget at the expense of what probably initially the intention was with this budget, spending on development in places like sub-Saharan Africa.
Stefan Dirkhan, thank you very much. Well, as Bill Gates alluded to, the implications of these cuts are significant. Development agencies like Village Enterprise, which work across rural Africa and help people escape extreme poverty by supporting them open small businesses, may face challenges due to reduced funding. I've been speaking to two women who've received help from Village Enterprise. Stella and Dawa are refugees and they've settled in the Bidi Bidi refugee camp in Uganda. You'll hear first from Stella. She's opened a shop.
I do small scale business that can earn me money every day. I have sugar, I have salt, tomatoes, onions, silverfish, coffee. The business has really helped me a lot. I am able to meet my basic needs. I can buy food for my children. I can buy clothes, other things. I am even able to maintain myself than compared to before. Before, I cannot buy anything for myself, but as per now, because I am running the business, I can do anything for myself, for my children. They are even okay. They can eat balanced diet.
Do you look back and think, how have I made it here?
Yeah, when I look back, I really see this great change than when I came from my country. I really have nothing, but at least with the small business I have right now, I am seeing change.
So this a place where I send my pieces.
Dressed in a long green and black shift dress, turquoise flip-flops, a headscarf and a choker pearl necklace, Dawa explains what she sells on her market stall.
I have ordered some more pieces to be brought for me. This is what I used to sell in my place. I'm very proud because I have got a changes already in my life. Right away from the time we arrived in 2016 up to now, we have changes. As you can see, my face is shining. I'm able to buy food for my children. And even I am able to support my husband and buy for him whatever he likes.
He's a lucky man.
Sure. Sure. Of course, he's very lucky because me as being the wife, I'm able to buy shop. I'm able to buy food for the family when he has nothing on his hand. This year, my children are very smart, all in uniform. I'm able to buy school uniforms for my children. I'm able to support them with even sandals or school shoes. This is what I have seen, that it has been very great in my family.
That was Dawa and Stella. Well, Tadeo Murioki is the Chief Government Relations Officer at Village Enterprise. He works across Africa.
What worries us most is, you know, we have an ambitious goal of being able to impact the lives of 20 million households. And we want to do that primarily through African governments and also through international organizations, again, mostly who rely on funding from, you know, governments like in the US and in Europe. You know, if we do see decreased funding on that, then that's going to be able to slow. We will not be able to do that. As you have seen and you've noted, you know, African countries, you know, they already have significant challenges. You know, they're still recovering from COVID-19. You know, we still have, you know, several countries recovering from drought. You know, we have climate change that's really affecting our countries. So there's so many challenges, and also the big issue of debt, right? Most of the countries being affected by debt, being in debt distress.
You talked about the levels of debt that some African countries have. The Bill Gates Foundation notes in their report published today that in some instances, some countries are paying more in interest on that debt than they are paying for health and education. It's very worrying, isn't it?
It is very, very worrying. And, you know, this is, I would say, where we also need more advocacy in terms of either debt reduction or debt wipe-off, because I'm based in Kenya and I see the challenges, protest. You see, you know, there's been strikes in people getting paid, doctors getting paid, but also, you know, a lot of cuts in terms of also social protection programs. So, you know, that's the shift, because governments are being forced to prioritize paying debt because they do not, you know, want to have their credit rating affected.
Should African nations always expect aid funding from developed economies?
You know, African governments and Africans, we need to be, you know, figuring out how to internally use our own resources. But we also need to have our economies developed to a certain point that can happen. And we do need the support of governments to be able to do that. I think, you know, it's in terms of how do you improve even infrastructure. Africans and African governments do need to rely on their own. But we also, at this point in time, this is a support that we need. When I look at other countries, when I even think about India, which has done very well, but it still has some reliance on foreign aid. So we do need to, we are still not there yet, but I think it's a multifaceted sort of approach where, yes, effective resources, but don't also pull the rug under our feet when we really need that support. Otherwise, it's just going to make a bad situation to even get worse.
You mentioned that you are now getting money from more philanthropists. Is that enough to plug the gap left by the aid budgets which have been cut by governments?
Oh, no. I mean, what we get is really a drop in the ocean, right? And I think for us, what we do is mostly trying to get to do what we can with what we have and what we call maybe incubation or proof of concept. But the real change, the real work, it has to come from funding from government, because governments are the people who have the systems. They have the ability to collect taxes and also to get funding from multilateral and bilateral donors and be able to utilize that funding to reach a lot more people. Think about programs like social protection or what we are doing in terms of graduation, where you have to give grants to start businesses, right? We need lots of funding for that to happen. When you think about public health systems, people who are in places where they don't have any access and they're not able to afford medicine or to see basic health services, we need that funding from government to be able to do that. And philanthropy, yes, it can do, it can support, Bill Gates can be able to support, but ultimately that has to come from government.
That was Tadeo Marioki from Village Enterprise. He was speaking to me from Nairobi. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.
Fenwick. Now, there's more important economic data coming out of the US today. This time it's retail sales, which unexpectedly increased last month. And the data indicates that the economy remained strong throughout much of the third quarter. Well, to talk about this, we're joined by Fiona Sincotta. She is a senior market analyst at City Index. So what do you make of this data, Fiona? A lot of economists were forecasting a 0.2% decline in retail sales for August, weren't they?
Yes, that's correct. So it is slightly down from July, where we saw 1% growth. So there is a slowdown in growth, but it's still better than what we were expecting. So that shows us that the US consumer remains resilient, really, despite, signs of a cooling jobs market and easing wage growth. So yes, it's an encouraging data point for us.
Do we know what they're still spending on?
Yes. So what we're seeing is that it's more to do with online purchases. That's where sort of the strength is being seen, whereas sort of car dealerships are seeing weakness. So that's sort of what the data is showing us, is online spending is increasing, but sort of that bigger ticket items such as cars are seeing sort of a lower spending towards those.
Now, this report is published as the Fed officials prepare to gather for a two-day policy meeting where they will, of course, decide on interest rates. Could this sway their decision one way or the other?
Do you know, it's really difficult to know exactly what the Fed are going to do. We know that they're going to cut. I mean, that's pretty much guaranteed. The question is, will it be 25 basis points or 50 basis points? And the data has been quite mixed, really. We've seen signs that inflation, core inflation data we had last week, actually was a little bit hotter than expected. Then we've seen these retail sales, which are a little bit stronger. But then we've seen that the jobs market is showing signs of cooling. So there's a lot of data that they're going to have to weigh up. The market at the moment is favouring the bigger cut, is favouring the 50 basis point cut, and that's about 63% priced in at the moment. We've seen the Dow Jones reach record highs today on this optimism that the Fed's going to start cutting rates.
Fiona, we will wait and see what happens. I think this time tomorrow, how exciting. Stay with us. We'll come back to you just before we finish the programme. We're going to head to Thailand now, where the Prime Minister has launched a $13.5 billion cash handout programme for low-income earners and vulnerable groups, and it'll start next week. The government hopes it will boost the economy. So that's the Prime Minister, Paetongtarn Shinawatra, talking there about the expected jolt to the economy, which grew just 1.9% last year. Around 40 million people are expected to sign up to the handouts via an app on their mobile phones and are set to receive around $300 US dollars each. I spoke to Anantha Lakshmi from the Financial Times. She is their Jakarta correspondent.
This is phase one of the so-called digital wallet program to distribute about 10,000 baht to some 40 million Thais. And what they've approved today is the first phase. It's part of their efforts to boost the economy, which has been lagging some of its Southeast Asian peers. The Thai economy has been growing at just about 2% last year and has been much behind some of the economies in Southeast Asia. For instance, the largest economy in the region, Indonesia, has been growing at about 5%. The economy has been hit by weak exports, household debt. So this is one of the key policies for the government to stimulate economic growth.
But there are some concerns, aren't there, about whether they can actually afford it? Because it is a lot of money, isn't it?
It is indeed. The full program was initially expected to cost about $14 billion. And there have been questions over whether the government is going to be able to finance this program. The previous government had considered funding it through borrowings, but that plan was dropped because there are threats of legal challenges to the program. So what has happened today essentially is that it's a much smaller version that has been approved as part of the first phase and is only going to cost a fraction of the initial cost, which the government says it can manage.
But a political gamble for the new prime minister.
Yeah, absolutely. The new Prime Minister, Paetongtarn Shinawat, has been in power for just about a month. It's a program that her predecessor tried to implement for over a year, but it ran into severe resistance within Thailand, including from some former central bank governors and some prominent economists. It's pretty a bold move on her part to start off with the program so soon in her leadership.
That was the Financial Times, Anantha Lakshmi speaking to me a little bit earlier. Now, have you ever wanted to party all night long? Well, if you are up for that, you might want to head over to the city of Montreal in Canada, which is about to introduce 24-hour drinking licenses. They already exist in cities like Berlin and Tokyo, and officials say it'll bring in hundreds of millions of dollars. But does Montreal have the stamina for it all? Sam Gruet has been finding out.
It's Friday evening in downtown Montreal, Canada's French-speaking capital. On Rue Berry, pretty much the centre of the city's nightlife, there are bars and restaurants all along this wide pedestrianised street.
The best thing is the diversity. You have a lot of options. That's a great thing.
Despite being Canada's second largest city and culture capital, it wasn't until 2017 that the city officially began to invest in nightlife. Currently, bars and clubs around here close at 3 a.m. But earlier this year, Montreal announced it was going to introduce new 24-hour zones in some of its downtown, part of a wider plan to boost the nighttime economy.
We have an opportunity to support an economy that has been rising through years.
Erica Aunius is the city councillor behind it.
On the economic side, there's an opportunity to economic growth on that sector. But on the other hand, it's to also to reinforce the importance of the cultural scene in the nightlife.
A 2022 report valued direct spending in Montreal's nightlife at more than 1.6 billion US dollars, with 88 million going in tax to the government. Erica Aunius hopes the 24-hour zones will bring in hundreds of millions on top of that. But not everyone is a fan of expanding the nightlife, like locals Lisa and Dani.
I just don't like the vibe of nightclubs, like the fact that guys are going to hit on you and you just want to have fun. So I prefer like staying home with my friends and be comfortable, basically.
For now, I don't think it's a good idea because we don't have enough security for it. The metro, is it going to be 24 hours too? Because do they have the staff for it?
Well, as long as it doesn't go to my neighborhood, I'm fine with it because I don't live in that area. I live in a residential neighborhood, so I'm fine with that. But if it were to be in my neighborhood, no, I wouldn't be fine with that.
Along another wide pedestrianized street lined with bars and restaurants, I meet Sergio Da Silva, co-owner of Turbo House Club, and ask him about the 24-hour zones.
For us, it doesn't change much, but there are a lot of people who see that as like an absolute boon and can change a lot. But for me, you can't just say, here are some 24-hour bars, go nuts, but there's no infrastructure to sort of like hold that. There's no 24-hour public transport. There's no extra sort of security.
But Michelle Lavelle, who owns pub Le Noir just down the road, believes it will improve security.
All the venues close at 3 o'clock. At 3 o'clock is like madness. But if you expand the hours, less problem, less demand for security. That's my belief.
But creating 24-hour zones won't make a difference if people don't have the money to spend, says Sergio Da Silva.
No matter what you do, no matter what 24-hour policy you want to put in, if people can't afford it, it doesn't change anything.
When Montreal gets its 24-hour zones, it's clear the city needs to make sure there are enough customers to party all day and night.
That was Sam Gruet reporting there for Business Daily. You can listen to his whole programme by searching for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcast. Now, Fiona Sincotta is still with us. Several cities around the world are known for their 24-hour drinking culture. Las Vegas, or Sin City, New Orleans, Berlin and Tokyo. Is there evidence that it can improve the economy? And do we know by how much?
I don't know if there are sort of direct figures that will actually tell us that. I mean, I think there is the potential for it to improve the economy. Obviously, there's more spending, but there's also that point that was made that you do need to have the money in order to be able to spend the money. So I think in times perhaps when the economy is doing well and consumption is high, then that's when it's going to be encouraged and it's going to be good and it's going to be helping the economy. But perhaps when consumption is low anyway, because people are sort of watching what they're spending, or it's sort of, you know, interest rates are high, etc., maybe there's just not the money quite yet to be going into discretionary spending at that level.
And the thought that occurred to me was increased costs from security, as was mentioned there in Sam's piece, and also transport costs as well. Fiona Sincotta, as ever, thank you very much for joining us on World Business Report. Fiona is from City Index. Today's producer was Isabel Woodford. I'm Sam Fenwick, and I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join me then.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in Ireland. An unprecedented riot in Dublin last year forced the issue into the mainstream, in a country where immigration concerns have not typically been a big political issue. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world.